Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Here's what I'd like you to do today. Set up a graph in your head. It's got a black background, two axes, of course, X and Y, money and time. And now imagine a big, glowing red dot right in the middle of the graph. This dot is March 2020, the pandemic, of course. And from this glowing red dot, okay, here's what you do now. You imagine two lines. One line is green, and it's going up and up and up. The other is dismal and gray, and it's going down, down, down. So imagine this. Time is marching on in our graph, and now it's April 2020. Millions of Americans, like William from Opelousas, Louisiana, are being dragged down that terrible gray slope.
This is going on the fourth week now that I've lost wages. I am homeless, and it's just a horrible situation, and I am running out of options, I'm running out of food, and we really need some help out here on the streets. Where's the help from the government? I need help bad.
William called us on April 7th, 2020. So yes, that thin gray line on our graph here, the one we're imagining, the one plunging towards the abyss, that thin gray line is the virtually unprecedented amount of sudden unemployment this nation experienced last year. In April 2020, more jobs were lost than in any other month in U.S. history, more than 20 million jobs. Unemployment reached 14.7%, and when you factor in the underemployed, that number plummets further to 22.8%. Okay, meanwhile, look up. Remember, we're still in this imaginary graph of ours we're constructing in our head. So look up. You remember that bright green line heading northward on this graph? Well, there it goes. Still rising.
Stocks soar on serious optimism. All three major U.S. indices rose on Monday considerably. The S&P 500 rose about 3.1%, and the 10-year Treasury yield rose from about 0.65% to 0.73%.
Now, of course, the market had bottomed out on March 23rd, that first big shock after the pandemic, not to be ignored. But by the end of 2020, the S&P up more than 16%, the Dow up 7.25%, both at record levels. NASDAQ up 43% by the end of 2020. As one money manager told the Washington Post, quote, stocks ending the year 15% higher in a pandemic? Mind-blowing. 2020 has been stunning. Well, of course, now again, we're back in that graph of ours. Between that rising bright green line and the plunging dark gray one is a gaping black maw of questions. Why did the world turn upside down and the rich got richer when the economy basically shut down? What are the causes of this period of American inequality? Beyond the pandemic, this was American inequality seemingly on steroids. So there are many subtle answers to those questions. But Karen Petru says there's one place that hasn't garnered enough scrutiny as a major engine of American inequality. And she joins us now. Karen, welcome to On Point. So what is this place that we're not looking closely enough at?
Well, this place is our central bank, the bank of banks in the United States, the Federal Reserve.
The Federal Reserve. Okay, so Karen is a managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. So she's a banking insider, and she has a book out. It's called Engine of Inequality, The Fed and the Future of Wealth in America. So make your case here, Karen. What did the Fed do that stretched out the distance between that rising green line and that plummeting gray one in 2020?
I think it's important to know what central banks are. They are the money fought the fountain of money in any economy. The Federal Reserve in the United States does its best and generally accomplishes setting interest rates. And since 2008, it's done something else. It has held trillions of dollars in assets, trying to affect how the financial market works. And so when you talk about that middle between the green line up, 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 and the dismal gray line you described so well, what makes those lines of economic inequality, lines of income and wealth, move? Well, it's the force there is money, and there is no entity in the U.S. economy whose job 24/7 is moving money. So that's why when I started to think about economic inequality in 2016, watching what was going on in the economy, as well as what was happening in the election and how just darn angry everybody was, that I think, why is the money moving so incredibly unequally? And the first thing I thought of, partly because it's my day job, is what is the Fed doing? The Fed moves the money. Why is it moving with that yawning chasm? Mm. And that's why I decided to write the book.
Okay. So really the key thing here is not just the existence of the Fed or what it does, but what it has been doing specifically after 2008. That's what you're saying. Now, we're going to come back to that in just a second, but I think it's helpful right now, Karen, to get a little bit of Fed 101 from you so that we have this common understanding. I mean, what can you just give us the quick definition of what you say the Fed's exclusive job is in the American economy? I mean, it's written up in the charter, so how would you describe it?
Well, the Fed's charter is often misunderstood. People say it has a dual mandate. In law, if you look at the critical statutes, it has a triple mandate. It is supposed to set maximum employment, defined, if you read the law, interestingly, as general welfare. The Fed is required by law to look at not just how jobs are measured by one index, but what you said at the beginning of the show, Ben, about the labor force, who's looking for work, who's not finding work. That's charter number one. Charter mandate is, in law, price stability, which the law says must be measured by purchasing power. And mandate number three is, quote, moderate interest rates. So the Fed's mandate is full employment, purchasing power for the middle class, and moderate interest rates. And on every one of those grounds, it has failed since 2008.
I mean, you could say that near zero interest rates, there's nothing moderate about that. But what are the levers that the Fed can then pull in order to achieve these three goals?
Well, the Fed has enormous power. It prints money. And it has used that money since 2008 to give the banks trillions of dollars, to give the financial system trillions in cash in return for certain assets, treasury obligations, and certain housing bonds. And right now, the Fed holds $8.7 trillion in assets, which is about a third of Americans' GDP. Nobody has that. Nobody's Daddy Warbucks that big. Nobody, not Jeff Bezos, not Elon Musk, not a single one. The Fed is a money pot. But it's more powerful than that because it also sets interest rates. There's an awful lot going on every the TV, the radio. What will the Fed do Wednesday when it meets to set rates? Will they go up? Will it, quote, taper its portfolio? And the markets are all holding their breath because the Fed moves the financial markets and sets interest rates. And I didn't mention another thing the Fed does. It sets the rules for the banking system. So it essentially tells banks to whom it is profitable to lend or not lend. And so it defines the banking business and whether average families get the loans they need, the financial services they need, or if those only go to the wealthy. That's what the Fed does, and it hasn't done it well.
And you're one of the few people, I think, who we can credibly say has read all of those Fed banking rules, which we'll come to here in a minute. But let's cut right to the chase here, because I'm already hearing some pushback to this thesis, even though we haven't really dug enough into it yet, which we will. But we've got a comment here from Alex Haginson, who says, please, after all the Fed did during the pandemic, we could have had economic Armageddon were it not for the Fed. And I think you could make the same argument for 2008, which is really where your analysis begins, because when we talk about that massive expansion of the Fed's balance sheet, that expansion came in an attempt to save the economy from utter collapse. So what's the problem, Karen?
The problem isn't what the Fed did in 2008 or 2020. The problem is what it didn't do from 2007 and before, or what it didn't do from 2010 to 2020. In 2008 and in 2020, the Fed intervened enormously because its actions beforehand had helped to make the financial system so weak that it couldn't withstand the shock, even certainly the pandemic. A macroeconomic shock of that unprecedented magnitude would have been a problem. But the Fed had to go into finances hugely as it did because the financial system was a lot weaker than it should have been. And that's the Fed's fault. More importantly, in 2008 and in 2020, it kept the spigots open years after the economy began to recover. And so all of the distortions I mentioned of financial markets, of interest rates, stayed even though by the Fed's own reckoning, the economy was not in 2010 and after recovering. And even in the middle of 2020, the Fed said growth was, quote, robust. Well, when growth is robust, the Fed shouldn't own the markets. It stifles natural economic behavior. And that's why economic inequality gets so big so fast.
Okay. So, but then, of course, when we come back, we'll talk about why, even during, as you said, robust growth periods, they just can't quit those low interest rates. So we'll talk about that in a moment. We're talking this hour with Karen Petru. She's managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics, a federal consulting firm she founded in 1985. Very much, I'll call you a banking insider here with deep knowledge and insight, and author of Engine of Inequality, The Fed and the Future of Wealth in America. And we're talking about the Fed's role in inequality, and especially it's urgent now given the current state of inflation and possibly a new Fed chair being named any day. So we'll talk about all that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Karen Petru is with us today from Washington. She's author of the book Engine of Inequality, The Fed and the Future of Wealth in America. And we're taking a close look at the Federal Reserve for a number of reasons. A, because Karen says it's a place that hasn't been scrutinized enough in terms of its role in creating vast amounts of economic inequality in this country. B, the Fed's role right now in the economy is rather important. And C, who knows? We could have a new Fed chair any day here. But Karen, before we get more deeply into sort of what the Fed has done to set itself up as this engine of inequality historically, as you've written, I want to just go back to our little mental graph here from the beginning segment, because can you explain as clearly as you can in that moment in particular, right? What was it that the Fed did that really put those, you know, that green stock line on steroids and creating that bigger distance between the wealthiest Americans and the not? I'm looking here. I was looking back at some of the things that Fed Chair Jerome Powell said in that time. And he said in March of 2020, he would do whatever it takes to stabilize financial markets. And The markets responded really well to that. They said no matter what happens with the pandemic, statements like that from Powell, quote, dwarf everything else in importance. And why?
That's because, as I said before, the Fed moves the money, and the Fed threw the money at the financial markets. And to your listeners' earlier point, yes, we had a terrific crisis, but the Fed threw the money into the markets, not into the economy. You know, anybody who studied stock markets, all of us who are investors, defenders of the market, they always say markets prices are fundamental. People who believe in old school economics tell you economics is rational, but the price of a stock tells you what its earnings are going to be. Well, you can really see what the Fed did to the markets, because when the fundamentals went to hell, to be blunt, as you said, the economy shut down and unemployment, real measure of how the economy is doing, plummeted, the markets went way up. And none of that generated growth. It generated wealth. Wealth for the people who already had it, not for those who needed it.
I'm seeing here that, according to an analysis from December of 2020, that the Fed pumped more liquidity into markets last year than they did after the financial crisis of 2007-08. Does that match with your understanding?
It is. And the difference is that in 2008, that was a financial crisis. And you could argue, I think incorrectly, but you could argue that the Fed needed to throw that amount of liquidity into the markets and then to keep the spigots open because of the nature of that crisis. But 2020 was a financial crisis sparked by a macroeconomic crisis, and you couldn't fix that financial crisis on its own. You had to fix the economy. And shoveling more money into the market didn't fix the economy. It hasn't fixed the economy. Look at where we are now, a year later, where the markets are up 35% year over year, and millions of Americans remain out of work, even though inflation now is running rampant.
Yeah.
You know, it's still not working.
I'll be perfectly honest. Last year, we were very focused on unemployment and the impact of the pandemic and the economy shutdown on people. So I didn't actually pay that close attention to what the Fed was doing with markets. So when you say it was shoveling money, shoveling liquidity into the markets, exactly how was it doing that?
It was buying assets out of the financial market. It buys treasuries and other housing bonds. And so if investors who hold them, the Fed gives them money and it takes the assets out of the market and holds them on its portfolio. And that money, then people buy stock with it.
Okay.
They're supposed to build factories with it. They don't. They buy stock.
I see. So that expansion of the balance sheet again. So this is where it mirrors 2007-08. So if you can just hang on here for a second, Karen, we wanted to look back in time a bit. So we talked to Thomas Honig, who was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City from 1991 to 2011. And by the way, he agrees in part with your thesis, Karen. And in 2010, a few years after the 08 financial crisis, Honig essentially told us he tried to do something about it. At the time, he was on the Federal Open Market Committee, which sets monetary policy for the United States.
And during that year, as a voting member, I voted against the proposals for quantitative easing and for having zero interest rates indefinitely, and for the significant buying of both mortgage-backed securities and treasury securities over that period, because I was concerned about how that policy would affect, I use the word allocation resources, which is another word perhaps for causing inequality, although I did not use that word.
In 2010, the Federal Open Market Committee was made up of 12 members, and Honig was the only one to vote no against the proposals.
At that time, I said, I hope I'm wrong. I hope that I am incorrect about this. But my experience in the crisis of the 80s and the experience of history, if you will, about a very expansionary zero interest rate printing of money convinced me then that this would result in these misallocations and what we now call some inequalities from that. So I don't feel good about it. I don't feel that I wish that it had not occurred, but I was concerned that it would occur, and I think it has in many ways today. So it is of importance that people learn from this and understand what, in fact, was part of the contribution to that in terms of the Fed's monetary policy.
However, Honig says he wouldn't go as far as to say the Fed should fix inequality.
It's a lot to ask the Fed to fix inequality. I think the real issue for the Fed was and is not to contribute to it.
That's Thomas Honig, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City from 1991 to 2011. And today he's a distinguished senior fellow at the Mercatus Center. So Karen, just tell me briefly, what do you hear in Thomas Honig's analysis of the actions that he himself took or voted against, I should say, in 2010?
First, I have to say I really agree with him. My book doesn't say the Fed can fix inequality, because it is a deep structural problem in the United States. What I'm saying is the Fed can reduce it by not playing the enormous role it does. It's not the sole cause of economic inequality. The Fed is just an important cause, and we don't need that. This country is so unequal. Anything we can do, we should do. But, well, you know, Tom Honig wasn't alone in 2010. Other members of the non-voting members agreed with him. They just lost.
Okay, so let's dig in here now. Now it's time to really do this. So you, you explained to us clearly sort of the levers that the Fed has and the role that it plays in the economy. So that, let's talk about the first one, the interest rates question, because I just sometimes I imagine every Fed announcement around interest rates is like almost like a papal announcement where everyone's just like gathered around the Vatican and waiting to see what color smoke comes out to see how like the markets are going to react. But in all seriousness, we have been in this long term period of near zero or very, very low rates being set by the Fed, as you pointed out, even through periods of robust growth. So why can't the Fed quit those interest rates, quit those low interest rates?
Because it's scared. It is now, this is a classic problem. It has taken over so much of the market. It's a third of U.S. GDP with its portfolio. As you said, the markets are... it's tender hooks waiting for this. It didn't used to be this way. When the markets ran the markets, what the Fed did in them was important, but it wasn't the only thing that is important. So when you are, when you're that much of a giant, you have to really watch where you step, and it's just frozen in place.
Do you think that it'd be more able or more willing to nudge interest rates up if its balance sheet were lower, smaller?
I think we would have a more equal, not necessarily an equal, but we would have a more equal economy if the Fed was not the only entity turning the dials and private sector companies and investors move their money based on where they saw opportunity, not based on what they think the Fed is going to do. That's a huge distortion in the markets.
Okay, so
we've gotten used to it, so we forget about it, but it's never happened before.
Yeah. And so why have we gotten used to it, right? Because you can look across various Fed chairs, right? And Yellen, Bernanke, Powell, Greenspan, I guess those are the four from recent decades. There hasn't actually, regardless of who it is, Ben Bernanke, whose scholarship was about the Great Depression, Janet Yellen, labor economist, none of them really deviated from this fundamental behavior of the Fed over many decades. And that's because I think, are they all still, adhering to the conventional wisdom that low interest rates, you know, produce an economy that grows, so they just can't step back from that?
Yeah, that's right. They're not. I know several of them well. I respect, I like them. They don't mean to be doing this. But we all, and I'm of their age, we all learned our economics when America had a huge middle class. And the theory they practiced worked quite well when America had a middle class with the discretionary income to respond with purchases and productive behavior when interest rates changed. We have now an America in which the top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90% included. So that economy, our economy now, It's gotten much more unequal after 2008. Doesn't work the way the theory predicts, but the Fed is stuck in the hole of its theory.
Huh. Okay, so what's your first prescription then on how to get out of that hole?
I think the Fed, because it is this giant and it will inadvertently crush things if it moves too precipitously, it has to step back very cautiously, but determinedly and carefully. It needs to reduce its portfolio more quickly than it's likely to announce it's going to do on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. The Fed is going to, quote, start to taper. Everybody believes it will. I think it will, but very, very tiny amounts. It needs to move faster. So again, the economy can work more freely. It needs to allow rates to rise, partly to reduce some of the inflation we're seeing now, partly because one of the real underlying causes of American inequality, which nobody talks about, and I hope we can a little bit, is the fact that when rates are below zero after taking inflation into account, anybody who saves is a dope. If you put your money in the bank like you were taught to because you want a down payment or you sound, you know, safe retirement or put a kid through college without too much debt, your savings account will earn 0.06%. Inflation last month was 5.4%. Look at the difference. You're losing 4.7%, right? Mm. And the market's going up 35% year over year. Savings is a waste of time, if not worse. Speculation is where the money is. That's a very distorted economy, and the Fed needs to begin to raise rates to a real rate where savings rewards those who save, not those who speculate.
Mm. Well, so following up on that, though, I keep coming back to it, almost the fear of market reaction to rate increases. So would it have to also be, as the tapering you're describing, very, very, very slow, so that, you know, we don't have this like swooning of the markets because they're being weaned off that free money, essentially?
I think the Fed is a little more worried about what seems like swooning, but might just be investors putting their hands over their brow because they want the Fed to keep funneling money at them. If you look at the taper tantrum, it was a very modest correction. It was really nothing. And it scared the Fed so that the Fed just refused to taper. The Fed is very easily frightened. You know, markets used to go down. And in fact, it's a good thing when they self-correct. I think the Fed needs to be careful, as I said before, but it doesn't need to be petrified.
You know, you just said something that it shouldn't stop me in my tracks, but it's true. I mean, markets do go down. We did see that, in fact, in March of last year, right? I noted earlier at the top of the show that there was a massive drop in the markets in the first response to the pandemic. You know, that wasn't pretty either. So how much, you know, like how can the Fed be expected to essentially manage how a correction unfolds?
Well, think about it, though. What happened? The markets dropped enormously because if markets look at fundamentals, the fundamentals in March were very, very frightening. What also happened that didn't get the attention that it deserves is that the markets, not stock prices, but the financial markets, the money markets, froze. Not because there wasn't any money anymore. There was still a lot of money. Remember, money didn't disappear with the pandemic. It was still all in the bank. But everybody decided to hold on to it. And while the banks in 2020 were more resilient than they were in 2008, the money market funds and other segments of the economy that had ridden all that speculation from 2010 to 2020 with no rules, banks were very carefully regulated in the wake of the great financial crisis. The rest of the market, remember what I said about speculation, it was Yahoo. And the Yahoo side of the market blew. And that's where the Fed threw the trillions. The Fed did not throw the trillions into areas that would have supported employment. It supported the ongoing functioning of the money markets. Now, that needed to happen. I'm not saying it shouldn't happen, but it kept doing that afterwards, and it has not to this day, other than say, gee, we need to do something about the speculative side of the money market. It's done nothing since.
Huh. Well, let's just go back in time a little bit, because this links to one of your like very concrete suggestions that you have about what the Fed can do now. I just want to hear from July 22nd, 1999, then Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, responding to Bernie Sanders, who had questioned him in 1999 about the growing wealth gap in America. And here's what Greenspan said.
Let me just say that the crucial question I think you have to answer is whether or not if somebody gets wealthy, it's at your expense. It's by no means clear to me that these have in any way been extracted from other people in the society. They are the consequence of new ideas, new wealth creation, and have been fundamental factors in pulling the whole economy up. And I would in no way consider that that is a negative force in a free society.
Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan in 1999. We'll get Karen Petrou's response to that when we come back from a break. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today's Monday. Wednesday on the show. So a little later this week, we're going to be talking about paid family leave, not on the books for the U.S. in the near future right now, which is why we wanted to take a look at what's happening in 185 other countries that have made it possible for some kind of government-funded paid family leave program. How did they pull it off? And what lessons can we learn here in the United States? So we're going to hear stories from mothers in various countries around the world and families, I should say, mothers, fathers, caregivers of all kinds. So we want to hear your stories. What was it like for you when you needed parental or caregiver leave in the United States? We're at 617-353-0683. 617-353-0683. That's for a show we are going to put on the air on Wednesday. Today, we're talking with Karen Petrou. She's author of Engine of Inequality, The Fed and the Future of Wealth in America. And we're taking a look at Karen's thesis that the Federal Reserve plays a thus far insufficiently scrutinized role in the expansion of inequality in this country and what to do about it. And Karen, I just wanted to get your quick response to what you heard there from that archival tape of former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan saying it was not clear to him at all in 1999 that Fed policies led in any way to, quote, extraction of wealth from other people in society.
Well, my book has a long discussion of this because you really raise an important point. That's the so-called wealth effect. And it's very similar to the supply-side economics we saw in the 1980s, the Ronald Reagan and Congress's pretty much ever since, which is that if we make the top 1 or 10% richer, money will trickle down. The wealth effect creates more wealth because wealthy people buy stuff, essentially, or use services, and that creates jobs, and everybody else gains from the wealth effect. And it might be true that, it wouldn't be so bad if the rich got richer if the poor didn't get poorer. But there's a fundamental economic concept behind this called propensity to consume. That theory, the wealth effect that Mr. Greenspan just talked about, assumes that rich people spend money in ways that generate growth. And it turns out, again, we don't have a middle class. We had a big middle class. The top of the middle class did spend money. Hey, honey, let's go buy a car. You know, we really need a new lawnmower. Even Jeff Bezos doesn't need another house. And if he bought a house, it's not the kind of house that would generate neighborhood wealth, except in Beverly Hills, which really doesn't need it. The economy, the wealth effect is only good for the wealthy.
But isn't the best way to push back against that wealth effect, not necessarily, it's not the Fed's role, but like tax policy, perhaps?
The tax policy is important, but remember what we talked about. Look at the markets. That's the Fed. Where does the wealth come from? Taxes take away wealth. I'm talking about where is the wealth? How do you creating all that wealth, all that speculative gain? Once it's there, you might equalize the economy by taxing or even confiscating it. I mean, we've certainly seen that in the Bolshevik Revolution. That's what used to happen to oligarchs in the French Revolution. People took the money because they just got really angry about people not just holding on to wealth, but not letting anybody else share in it. But it's not about the taxes. It's about, first of all, the having of it.
Got it. Okay, so hang on here for just a second, Karen, because there obviously, as you know, well, there are quite a number of people who disagree, actually, with your fundamental premise that the Fed itself should play a direct role in trying to reduce inequality in America. For example, this is February of just this year, and current Fed Chair Jerome Powell testified before Congress, and Senator Elizabeth Warren asked Powell a series of questions, not just about income inequality, but wealth, as we were discussing in the U.S., and here is Powell's response.
You're getting farther and farther from the kinds of inequality that we focus on, and frankly, the ones that we can do anything about with our tools. We can't affect wealth inequality certainly in the short term.
Okay, so that's Jerome Powell. Then there's Ben Bernanke, who served as Fed chair from 2006 to 2014, throughout the late 2000s, of course, in the middle of the financial crisis as well. In 2018, he gave an interview to Jorge Ramos, where Ramos asked Bernanke if the U.S. was becoming, quote, the kingdom of the super rich.
I agree that the U.S. economy is not serving the broad population the way we'd like it to, that inequality is getting worse. It's been going on for a long time. This is not something, by the way, that the Fed can do much about. The Fed has only limited tools.
Former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke in 2018. Well, joining us now is Jeffrey Lacker. He's former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, and he served in that position from 2004 to 2017. He's currently distinguished professor in the Department of Economics at Virginia Commonwealth University. Professor Lacker, welcome to you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
And I appreciate you listening along as I've been talking with Karen Petru here. Does the Fed have a role to play in reducing inequality in America?
I'm a bit skeptical. I'm skeptical about the Fed as the primary driver of inequality historically. And I think Karen admits that in her book, that longer run factors like education and technology, this is the conventional research result that have been going on since the 80s, have been the primary driver. Now, Tom, the segment you had with Tom Hanig indicated clearly the extent to which we were well aware that lower interest rates, hold on, let me get that puppy, lower interest rates by themselves, what's going on there?
Popular man.
Yes, indeed. That lower interest rates by themselves, holding everything else constant, would raise equity prices and that would benefit the wealthy more than others. We're well aware of that, but the conventional view is that it was a collateral effect of policy actions intended to address what was going on in the economy. I'm skeptical, even if you set aside that who's been the primary driver of inequality, skeptical that the Fed should be taking an aggressive leading role. The Fed's an independent agency. It's run by unelected officials. The traditional principle, political norm, if you will, of independence of Fed policy making on a month-to-month, year-to-year basis from influence by the administration or Congress, I think is there for a good reason. There's a broader mission that is, of course, set by Congress, but tactical decision-making is left up to the Fed. The good reason for that is that politicians, at times, have an incentive to lean on the Fed to take actions to influence their reelection chances. Nixon, 1972, was the best example of that. But as a result, you have an institution, the Federal Reserve, whose very existence in some sense gives it the capability of circumventing Congress, circumventing constitutional processes that govern the allocation of taxpayer money and putting taxpayer money at risk. Using public resources to address inequality is a highly consequential and momentous political question. And constitutional democracies are built specifically to create mechanisms to manage the conflicts and trade-offs.
And can I just jump in here for a second? Because sure. What you're saying is very, very interesting, and it helped me understand. Because on the one hand, I think you're saying that one of the great things about the Fed is that ideally it is free from the kind of political pressures and influence that the rest of government is subject to. But on the other hand, I mean, those political pressures and influence in an ideal situation come from the very people to which government is accountable, the American people. And so, therefore, the Fed stands outside of that. So who should the Fed be accountable to then?
Well, I think the Fed's accountable to Congress for the results of its year-to-year, quarter-to-quarter tactical decisions on monetary policy, for the outcomes in terms of monetary stability and employment growth. I think it's accountable for the results of its action. You just don't want democracies around the world have found it better, leading to better results, if they delegate to an independent central bank the conduct of monetary policy, the influence of monetary conditions. It's like putting your credit card in a freezer, just raising an impediment to doing something that would benefit you in the short run, but wouldn't be in your best interest in the long run.
So here's my other question then. I mean, I hear we played that tape from Powell and Bernanke, and we've often heard that what Karen is asking for falls outside the purview of the Fed, and also falls outside what the Federal Reserve's tools can do. And yet what Karen is saying is the Fed has used those very same tools to great effect in the past and even now. It's just that the positive impact of that effect is going to a small number of people. So why can't it use those same tools to benefit more Americans?
It's a great question. I agree wholeheartedly with Karen that the Fed should step back from intervening in markets in ways that distort allocations. I was early on, mid-2008, arguing against the Fed's intervention to rescue investors in Bear Stearns. And I think they should take a pause and work their way out of the intervention in markets like corporate debt and the like that they've intervened in. They're too afraid of small market hiccups, and they intervene to save investors from the consequences of those choices. The Fed would be better off limiting itself to its role in monetary stability. But by the same token, I think giving them a mandate to address inequality it is also a bridge too far for the Fed.
Well, Jeffrey Lacker is former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond from 2004 to 2017 and currently distinguished professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So, Karen, respond to that. A bridge too far. What do you think?
Well, I think Jeff has said that he thinks the Fed should not have a mandate for economic inequality, and I would agree if that is for things like direct spending in the economy to buy bridges or set up jobs or operate cattle ranches. But I go back to what the law says. The current mandate, the one that gives the Feds its independence, requires the accountability to Congress that Professor Lacker described. Remember, I said at the outset, the Fed's charter by law calls for employment for everyone willing and able to work, price stability measured by purchasing power, and moderate interest rates. That's the law. It's not the way the Fed describes, quote, maximum employment and price stability. the law uses those terms as shortcuts for several sentences that go on to say a lot more. And the Fed has failed that mandate. And I would go farther to say if it continues to fail the mandate, it's going to lose its independence. Because you asked the right question about what happens when wealth isn't shared, and I said people get angry. Well, they're going to get really angry. And my goal in my book is to try to ensure that that anger doesn't become destructive. We've seen that all too much in the last 4 years, just rage, I hate you, rage. We need a constructive Fed. And if the Fed isn't quick to honor its true mandate, I fear it's going to be a part of the collateral damage of continued economic dysfunction.
Okay, so in the last few minutes that we have, on that note of what you believe the Fed could constructively and, in fact, concretely do, very interesting ideas here. So let's just at least hit two of them in the last couple of minutes, Karen. One of them is you remind us that when the pandemic struck, the Fed took some very specific action. You say it created two huge facilities to backstop giant corporate debt and opened a Main Street bank to deal with large businesses. And you said it could have and should have instead opened a family financial facility. What would that have looked like?
It would have looked like something that said, you know, because the Fed's law, let's go back to the law. Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act says the Fed should provide broadly based emergency liquidity support. Now, the Fed read that to mean broadly based lots of corporate debt, including even for highly speculative junk. And the term junk bond means what you think it means. It means, really high risk garbage paper. And Congress told it to do the Main Street lending facility. It wasn't the Fed's idea, but when the Fed didn't operate that well, not a whole lot of money moved. A family financial facility would have supported the families. You know, when people lost their jobs, they suddenly had a liquidity crisis. They had to figure out how they could continue to pay their bills. Overdraft fees, short-term loans. A lot of families went into a lot of high-cost short-term debt because they couldn't quickly recover, find a new job, do the best they could. And that's where a family financial facility, I view it as something that would operate through overdraft protections and credit card forgiveness. Why is the Fed supporting junk bonds and not families doing their best to pay their bills? That's a real liquidity crisis.
The point you're making is that there's nothing in the Fed charter that would prevent them from doing something like a family financial facility, right?
Not if it operated through the banking system, no. They can't do it directly.
Okay, but through the banking system, but that's when you get to the rules of the banking system that the Fed helps create. How would you say that they could change this unequal allocation of resources by adjusting banking rules?
Yeah, that's a little bit different from the question about what they should have done in March of 2020. But yeah, the Fed has set a lot of rules. And in my book, I have a discussion of how things like the risk-based capital rules have led the banks to abandon lending to low and moderate income households because banks are profit-making. If the rules say it costs you a lot of money to do a business because we think it's risky, we, the Fed, think it's risky, the banks stop doing it. And that's where you get payday lenders and all sorts of high-risk, high-cost lending to lower-income families. And in fact, in my book, I show there's a lot of data that depending on how you lend to lower-income people, it's actually a great business. It's a sounder business than lending to high-flying speculative investors who don't have other resources. Yeah. But the capital rules, the rules that define banking, make banking now a wealth management business.
Well, I think the big takeaway from me in your book is that these are choices the Fed can make. But the question is, will it?
That's right. That is.
We just got a couple of seconds.
Should it? Yeah. No, it should. It can. It should. And I fear it must, because we don't need this country to get any angrier than we already are.
Well, Karen Petru, author of Engine of Inequality, The Fed and the Future of Wealth in America. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation, Karen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a great, great pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.